All the House Judiciary together at 1:35. Did I take the recorder by my surprise? I think we're okay there, yeah. Today we have three bills in front of us, HB 73, HB 102, and HB 1. And we'll look at them in that order as time allows. We have with us today Representative Millett, Representative Grunberg, Representative Ledoux, Representative Lynn, and myself, Representative Keller. And I think where we're at, we have on the record a conceptual explanation of an amendment that Representative Grunberg is going to be presenting. Oh, and for the record, Representative Pruitt has joined us. And so he's got two amendments ready for us on HB 73. He's worked with the Department of Law, and the Department of Law, I'll let them speak for themselves, but I think no objection. And he's worked closely with Representative Ledoux, and Representative Ledoux is comfortable. So Representative Grunberg, we have before us.
This bill?
This bill.
Do you want to do that first?
Go ahead and do your amendment.
So okay.
HB 73 uniform is the one we have.
The new amendment?
No, that's good. Thank you. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg, do you have something to propose for HB 73?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I have two amendments today. And the first is labeled U.7.
I believe everybody has U.7 in front of us. We'll call out amendment number 4.
I move the amendment.
We got an objection for purpose of explanation.
As we discussed last time, section AS 2523-180I is a savings section, and it simply says that just because you bring a proceeding to terminate the perpetrator's parental rights on the ground, and we have the statute here, sub 3, basically, that they've committed a sexual assault that's resulted in the conception of the child, and that's attached to the packet here, that the parent committed an act constituting sexual assault or sexual abuse of the minor or a comparable offense under the laws of the state, et cetera, and that termination's in the best interest of the child. It does not affect the victim's rights to, currently it says sexual abuse of a minor or incest to obtain legal and equitable civil remedies for injuries and damages to the victim, the person who was raped. And this simply adds the term sexual assault because the victim, the mother, is quite possibly an adult and was an adult when the assault occurred. And it is discussed here in the memo. There should be two memos. One memo dated March 22 and another memo dated March 26. And this is certainly in line with Section 2 of the bill, which deals with the civil code and eliminates the statute of limitations for various offenses in the bill. And I'd ask that the amendment be adopted without objection.
Okay, we have an objection, but so is there discussion? Representative Ledoux.
Yeah, I worked with Representative, or talked extensively with Representative Grunberg on this, and based upon my understanding of this now, which, thank you, Representative Pruitt, who was able to, you know, begin to explain it to me the other day when I was so totally lost about it, I come to the conclusion that this is a good, you know, it's an appropriate amendment. Now, with that said, I look at this thing, and it's hard to believe that one actually needed that savings clause. But since we do have that savings clause, and it mentioned sexual abuse of a minor, then I would be concerned that if you don't add sexual assault to that, that a court would conclude, oh, you saved the right of action for sexual abuse of a minor, but you didn't save it for actual sexual assault, and would read into it that the legislature didn't mean to change that. I hope I'm not getting too much down of a rabbit hole here. Anyway, I think it's a good idea.
I want to say that I support the amendment too, but it's more on the basis of the fact that we put a lot of work in this thing, and it has been called, I quote, a good catch by someone in the Department of Law. But I do want to put a protest in. I'm not going to reject further. And the protest is that when I look at the fact that we're adding to the title and late in the process on this amendment, and it's a adoption issue that is right on the edge of almost, you know, violating, I guess, the several subject clause and all that, you know, in one bill. I'm doing it, but I'm doing it out of submission and respect for Representative Grunberg, who sees this as very important, as you have said. So anyway, I will not object further.
Can I comment on that? Because Mr. Chair,
yes.
I do want to confirm we're not going to violate the single subject clause, are we? Because actually, I think that this was a good catch. It is a savings from everything I can tell, and I think I'd like to include it, but I also don't want to create the problem. So maybe we should ask Kathleen if she sees any concerns.
Kathleen, thank you so much for calling and being available online. Did you hear the question, Kathleen Strassbaum?
I did.
Identify yourself for the record, please. And
yes, Kathleen Strassbaum, Legislative Legal Counsel. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pruitt, the single subject rule is always called into question when we have bills with lots of different subject matters. And in this case, in the case of HB 73, we have both this provision and provisions under Title 47. However, the courts are very unwilling to strike down legislation as a result of the single subject rule. And a person arguing in favor of this being within the same subject matter might well be able to show that there's a unifying theme to this bill having to do with relief of sexual assault and child abuse, among other things, in addition to the general criminal subject. So I don't think it's a fatal legal flaw, given the court's tendency to be very lenient in interpreting that rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, do you remove your objection?
I remove my objection.
Seeing no further objection, amendment number 4 carries.
Amendment number 1.
4, I'm sorry. That's labeled U.7, amendment number 4. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The members will see, we have two remaining amendments, U.8 and U.9. I'm offering U.9 with U.8 in reserve in case there's any question as to U.9. The definition of sexual assault, which appears in various places in the adoption code, is defined. And as you can see in U9, it only includes first degree assault, section 1141.410, or second degree sexual assault, 1141.420. It does not include, and if you members would look at the packet appended to U8, it does not include sexual assault in the third degree or sexual assault in the fourth degree, which is also appended to the amendment labeled U8. And the reason for that was that those crimes were not in existence when the underlying statute was initially adopted. And if the members would look at section 180, which is in its entirety.
Maybe I spaced it here, but did you move that amendment number 9 in?
I move amendment number 9.
Okay, and that's amendment number 5 for our records.
Object for discussion and because, dadgummit, Max. You got to give this to us before we come to the committee, buddy. This is complicated stuff.
Representative Millett.
Oh, I remember a promise that that was going to be the last amendment when our last bill was here. You promised this committee there would not be any more last-minute amendments.
And being that
is a promise.
And being the chair, I will get the last word in this. I will let him go ahead and make his amendment. But I do want to say that as a matter of process, this bill has been with us before, it's not what, four times? And it'd be very much in order for me to call this amendment out of order. And I'll try to do that fairly on all of you. Please, when we get a bill ahead of us and it's coming up, you know, we're wanting to take action on the bill and you know it and it's been there, don't wait till the last minute, please.
I apologize.
Now that you've been scolded, sir, Representative Gruenberg, go ahead.
There was a promise, though, on the record.
I could recall a floor debate when I wasn't here between Ron Larson and Terry Martin, but I won't on the same subject. I stand chastised, I'll say that. This only came to my attention as I was preparing the other amendment, and we've been working on this right literally up until about 10 minutes ago, so I do apologize. Anyway, if the members would look at Section 180, which is attached to the packet under U7. This is the entire underlying statute. And the heart of Section 180 that allows the termination action is in subsection C3. And that is marked. It's the second or third sheet, the third sheet from the bottom. And the relation of parent and child may be terminated by a court order on the grounds that the parent committed an act constituting sexual assault or sexual abuse of a minor, blah, blah, blah. And so when I looked at the definition, it did not include third and fourth degree sexual assault, because when C3 was adopted, there was no such, were no such crimes. And as the members will see, sexual assault in the third degree, which is attached to U.8, is that if they engage in sexual contact with somebody who is mentally incapable or incapacitated or unaware, or if they're a correctional officer and they engage in sexual penetration with somebody who's in prison, or with engage in sexual penetration with somebody 18 or 19 who the offender knows is committed to the custody of the Department of Health and Social Services, and the offender is a legal guardian, or if they're a peace officer, engages in sexual penetration. Those are very, very serious offenses, and certainly they should be covered as a ground for termination, and also, of course, the savings clause and everything else would apply. And sexual assault.
Representative Gruenberg, if you would, what are you referring to? I mean, we don't have the right paperwork.
Yeah, we do. He's referring to the amendment, the backups on the amendment U8. So the amendment he hasn't offered yet, the backups on that one. So
did you find it?
So he's referencing 25, 23, 180.
U8. Okay, I thought it was on the first. Okay, so what page am I supposed to be on in U8?
The crimes of first, second, third, and fourth are attached to Amendment U8. They are part of Kathleen Strassbaugh's memorandum. They're the second and third pages of that. That's the third degree sexual assault.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
So all you're doing, Max, is adding third and fourth degree sexual assault to this amendment. Adds third. Okay. It's a much easier way to explain it. So you're just adding third and fourth sexual assault to this bill.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And fourth degree sexual assault is set out on here also. If they're in a correctional facility and they have sexual contact, or they have sexual contact and it's the legal guardian under the Department of Health and Social Services, or it's a peace officer and they have sexual contact. And I wanted to put that in also, because sometimes it is possible to conceive if there's no penetration but sufficiently close sexual contact, and also because sometimes people plead down, and they might be charged with a higher crime, but plead out to the misdemeanor. And we're not talking about the crime itself, we're talking about the conduct, and this is serious conduct.
I found it.
Okay.
Thank
and
you.
I would ask Ms. Carpinetti and anybody from the Department of Law who's with her to come up and talk about this.
Kathleen, are you still online?
Yes, I am.
You're the drafter of the amendment. Would you, characterize what the amendment does, just to make sure that there's clarity here, and then address the title change? Is that a problem?
Not in this House. The title change, I don't see an issue. There does have to be one, but since this is the House's bill, it doesn't. It's okay. This amendment adds the two offenses. I'm not familiar with the history of the development of the definitions in 2523 that they amend, but it does add those two offenses to the definition, and that definition covers the entire adoption chapter 2523, so it informs all of the provisions of that statute of 180, which include both the termination, grounds for termination of parental rights without consent, and the savings clause that we discussed earlier.
Any questions for Kathleen? Department of Law, if you come up with any, and identify yourself for the record. And there's really no questions before us, but if you could give us just a general description of the amendment and what.
Sure. My name is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I don't practice in this area of the law, but I did call and have a discussion with Jan Rutherdale, who works in our Human Services section, and she. We went through the amendments together, and she thought that it was a good, as you described it, a good catch, an omission that was made back in the 80s, and it's a good thing to repair that omission.
Okay. Any other questions? You maintain your objection?
I will remove my objection.
Any other objection? Discussion? Okay. Amendment number 5 passes. Any other discussion or amendments on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
I just would like to put on the record that we talked at length last time about jurisdiction. And you'll remember we had lots of different examples of jurisdiction. And since then, I've had conversations with the Department of Law and various other people, Doug Gardner, et cetera, and decided not to offer that amendment. It doesn't go in Title 11, and we shouldn't just do a special jurisdiction for this one little statute. We need to look at the issue of criminal jurisdiction as a whole. It affects lots of crimes, and I've asked and I've talked with the chair about possibly, if he is agreeable, I request maybe as an interim project working with law and various other agencies and academics to see to come out with the very best, it's called a long arm statute, a jurisdictional statute for criminal law. And so I'm not offering it, but I remain most interested, and I'd volunteer to help in that effort.
Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to thank you and the committee for your exceptional patience with a very trying person.
Trying? Is that what you call it?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Was it above and beyond a call of duty? I don't know. We'll see. Representative Pruitt.
I just want to respond to that. I appreciate you bringing that forward, and I also appreciate the recognition that that is an incredibly complicated subject, and it probably takes additional time. But I think it's probably important for this committee to not let that drop, because I think that we identified it was something that several of us had been thinking of, and we definitely, I think, need to continue with it. But I appreciate not asking us to, in our effort to do something good, potentially force something through and have consequences that we may not identify. So thank you for that recognition, Representative Grunberg.
Any you represent Pruitt. I wish I had thought of that. That's very good words. I agree. Representative.
Yeah, I just like to say that I think it's an excellent interim project and that I would certainly be willing to add my 2 cents worth during the...
Agreed.
Absolutely. Thank you. We'll review it as you get us the materials, and sometime during the interim we may even get together. Who knows? That would be great. Thank you, Representative Gerber. Representative Lynn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is a good
bill. We have one more question. I'm sorry. Representative Pruitt.
I do actually have one more question that I want to, that if it would be okay. I think this would probably be for public safety, to tell you the truth. Let me find it. Let me pull it up. Section 12, I want to ask about the GPS monitoring that we have, or the discussions that we have in here. So that would be sections 12 and 13, which would be on page 7 and 8. The questions that I have, and I'll let whoever you guys choose. I'm not particular. I'm not particular here.
Don't be afraid.
If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ron Taylor, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Corrections.
And I just want to clarify, because you were...
That's
okay.
Safety.
Okay, that's great. I think public safety is getting out of the light, but, you know, just like Representative Grunberg, Representative Grunberg gives us surprise amendments in the committee if we can. If you know you're going to be asking questions of the department, try to give them a heads up. I saw her face get red, and I could identify
with I think we did try to give a heads up, though.
Okay.
We gave a heads up. That's why we know it's... That's why it's corrections that's here, not public safety.
Okay.
So, no, I appreciate that.
Okay, thanks.
I wanted to ask just briefly, and you should... This shouldn't come as a surprise. The guidelines that are in place, and I think Corrections already has guidelines, so that's why that you guys would be... What are the guidelines in place for these sections, the current, the global positioning and similar technology, and what vendors currently meet these guidelines?
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, actually the guidelines for this GPS system we have not developed yet. Okay. We would be working with the Department of Public Safety to do that. We currently are working with BI. I don't remember what the acronym stand for, but that's the company that's currently providing the services for us for electronic monitoring.
Can I follow up a little bit of dialogue here? Are they the only ones that can provide the service?
I don't believe so. I think there are other companies that are available that can provide the services. That was one of the ones that were providing the through an RFP process that we went through.
Okay, appreciate that. Now, follow up on in the same vein. The similar technological means that's right in there in that section 4 or section, it's under section 12, but it's number 4 there. It's the new portion we're adding. There's the line that says similar technological means. Can that also potentially be applied to other technology such as ignition interlocks?
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, I'm not exactly sure. I haven't looked at it for ignition interlock, but we can certainly get that information back to you.
Okay. Because I see the concern I have, and I'll be very clear, that it came from a former constituent, now one of his constituents, that is somehow involved with it. And he read this and notified me and said, I'm concerned that it may limit people's... This may create a form where he may not be able to potentially participate in... he may not be able to participate, I guess. I'll just leave it at that. And so it was brought up this just very recently by a constituent that was concerned that this might basically write him out potentially at some point. I don't know the details. I apologize that you're getting into a world just like some of this I'm learning. That's something that I learned. That's why I asked the question is the last thing I want to do is potentially put something in here that may limit certain people from being able to provide the services. And I know the GPS has been a really kind of a controversial thing overall in multiple cases, multiple levels, or maybe we couldn't actually provide it. I just wanted to see, I just was hoping that we might be able to get an answer on that. It could be read for other things outside of GPS as well, and potentially other things like interlocks.
Through the chair to Representative Pruitt, I don't believe so, but I can certainly check into that for you.
I appreciate that.
Okay.
If you would. So, Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
Okay, I was just thinking if there is a further concern, I believe the Senate version, you know, I think they're scheduling a hearing tomorrow. And so if you see something, maybe you could bring it up there or on the floor. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think it goes to finance.
It does go to finance.
Oh, yeah,
I am most
interested
in what you find out.
Yeah.
And I would hope that maybe the department can let, through the chair, department can let the chair or Representative Pruitt know, and through them the rest of the committee, because I share your concern.
Yeah, and I'm Mr. Chair, I have no intent on holding the bill up. I will work with other committees on it. But I apologize that this was one of those recent things. Otherwise, just like I got on, I kind of laughed with Representative Grunberg. I mean, I had no intent on bringing this right as we were releasing this bill out of the committee. So.
Representative Brewer, in lightheartedly, you didn't make a promise yesterday.
Well, I almost missed the bill signing because there was a lot of but thank you.
The spoon. Yeah, remember that
song
about the soup?
Representative.
You could have kept your promise. Representative Grunberg could have kept his promise and at the same time brought the amendment by just bringing it all in one amendment.
I wanted to be careful. We didn't have something that somebody else.
Just joking, Max.
Well, I think we've, is there further discussion on the bill? I think we've done a lot of work on the bill, and I think that, you know, probably none of us are completely comfortable with all the parts of it. I know I'm not. There's some parts of it that make me a little bit uneasy, but there's always the option of coming back and doing it in another round if we need to. So,
Mr. Chairman, first of all, Reverend Grunberg, there's a group out there called Promise Keepers. You might, you might check into it. A little different subject, but the same idea. But I think it's a very good bill overall. No bill is perfect, but I think this does work as intended to do. And with that, I would.
Oh, wait a second.
Before we do that,
Representative Millett.
Could we ask Annie to come up just real quick? Is that okay? Sorry. I guess I should call you Ms. Carpinetti. I feel like I've seen so much of you that we're best friends.
Representative Millett, go ahead.
So with the changes that we've made and the amendments that have been made in this committee, is the administration and the criminal division comfortable with the bill and the outcomes of the bill up from our committee?
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that was on the record.
Good question. Thank you.
Again, Mr. Chair, I would respectfully move House Bill number 73, 28-GH, 1587/U with as amended and amended and amended and amended.
And a company.
And a company in fiscal note.
Okay.
Thank
with
you
that,
very much.
You bet. The bill moves and we'll go ahead and take a brief at ease while we do the paperwork and get ready for HB 102. Sure right now that everybody has version N of HB 102 in front of you? Just,
maybe you should Max the bill packets?
Oh, no, I don't. This is your bill, right?
HB 102, yes.
No, I don't have
it. Are you sure?
I had one. It's long in here. It was in your last year. Come on.
We're back on record, so.
This is your bill, Wes?
Yes. Yeah.
This has been around for a while.
This one has been around for a while. And we've got expert testimony, and I wish I could sit here and tell you that I am a real expert in trusts and such and can answer all your questions. I cannot. But I will tell you that Commerce Committee has spent significant amount of time on this thing. I'm comfortable with where we're at. We're going to get the description of the changes that have been made. And if you're comfortable, we will press on. Version N, Representative?
We're not dealing with you. Huh?
No, we're with N. N is
Are we going to deal with you, or should I toss it?
Labor and Commerce, you can toss it, because Labor and Commerce has given us this new version. So what we're going to do is I'm going to ask my staff to go out and stand there by the microphone, and we'll take shots at him instead of me, and a lot more comfortable. Not really. What we got is Dave Schaftel is online. We'll have Ernest go out here, but maybe he can help us out and guide us as we go. But Dave Schaftel, if you're online, if you would identify yourself and give us an overview of the bill, and as you're going through, you might describe the changes that Labor and Commerce made. If you're there.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am. I'm Dave Schaftel. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, Alaska. I work in the trust and estate area. Since about 1997, I've been part of a group of attorneys and trust officers who have worked with the legislature to suggest changes and improvements to our trust and estate laws. And the legislature has enacted and improved this area. This is another bill that it really has been worked on over about 3 years now. It was before your committee last session, and your committee approved it and passed it out in substantially the same form. There have been a few additions to it. It got to finance, but it was right at the end of the session, and it didn't get to the floor for a vote. But it's been through, I think last year it was through the same two committees, and this year, again, it's as Mr. Chairman, you've mentioned, it's been through Labor and Commerce, and it's now before you again. It's an excellent bill. It brings up to date a number of different areas of the trust and estate law, including Uniform Acts, that, for example, the Uniform Principal and Income Act, which has been adopted by numerous states. Each state kind of crafts it to their own situation. There were the IRS adopted regulations to relating to this act, and the amendments here before you bring our version of that act up to date, which adds flexibility in the area of allocation of uniform of principal and income. It amends the Uniform Trust to Minors Act, and Representative Grunberg has been very much involved in this and really was the catalyst to the amendments here, enacting flexibility for these accounts so that they can be extended for the benefit of the minor who then turns to the age of majority but wants this kind of custodial arrangement continued. And so develops flexibility there. Makes amendments relating to retirement provisions, retirement accounts, so that beneficiaries of these accounts, their interests are protected. This enacts the majority rule following about 12 other jurisdictions that have had litigation and have adopted a majority rule in this area protecting the interests of beneficiaries. And this bill also allows for the transfers of IRAs to trusts for tax planning purposes. Life insurance area, this bill clarifies that life insurance can be held in a life insurance trust. This is a very standard approach to protect the proceeds of life insurance and to make sure they're not taxable under the federal estate tax. Universally used throughout the country, but our insurable interest statute was ambiguous in this area. That was caught by one of the practitioners, and this remedies that ambiguity. For the first time, this Alaska, if this bill is approved, would have provisions for the disposition of human remains. This has caused problems for a number of people where there have been arguments over where a burial would occur or whether it be a burial or cremation, who would have the decision-making power in that area. And this bill contains a priority list. It also has a form that a person can fill out before their death, establishing that priority and who has the right to give directions. In the area of community property, back in 1998, the legislature enacted an optional community property system, which has been very attractive, and I know most of my clients use this system. It provides a federal tax law in the income tax area, allows for an adjustment of basis of both halves of the community property at the death of the first spouse. And this is a very attractive tax benefit. We're now the 10th state to have community property. The bill also improves the area for modifying trusts. And this is a developing area that over the past 15 years is called decanting. Of course, that means pouring wine from one bottle into another, and that's been the vernacular for taking the assets of one trust and putting them into another trust to cure problems with the first trust. We have such a statute. We followed New York. We were the second state to have this back in the late 1990s, and New York has adopted a much more sophisticated decanting statute, and we're following their lead with decanting provisions here. So that's kind of an overall global view of what this bill does. We put a lot of work into this. It's been before a number of committees. I think it just had to do with the crush of business last year that it wasn't enacted then. But I'm certainly happy to try and respond to any questions or add any clarification I can. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Is there any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. What is a law in the state of Alaska for insurance policies? I just was asking Representative Groenberg, I'm not familiar with it. Can I take out a life insurance policy on Max? Can he take one out on me? Even though we're not related, we have no business interests together. How does that work for Alaska?
To the chair, is this Representative Millett?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry. I just missed your name. The answer is no. You probably cannot take out a policy on Max, nor vice versa. You have to have, this is what's called an insurable interest. And it has become something of a controversial area in some states where they don't have an adequate statute, and there have been people who have tried to do that. But the basic public policy concept, and this is very strongly supported by the insurance industry, is that you can't gamble on somebody else's life. You have to have some kind of an interest. You have to be related to that person or share a business interest.
Representative Groenberg.
Thank you. Mr. Schaftel, this is Max. I thought that there's something that's brewing. I didn't know if it was in this bill or something else, where people were doing some kind of a scam or something going back and forth with insurable interests and stuff. And I thought maybe there was some legislation involved to deal with that. Dave, do you know what I'm talking about? Because I don't remember the details.
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, yes, this is what's called STOLI, which is a stranger-owned life insurance, is the vernacular for it. And this bill certainly does not get into that area at all. This is, as I say, the insurance companies are very much against such gambling with life insurance policies, but no, this bill does not do that. It's been reviewed by a national group that represents the insurance companies, and this review occurred in the prior committee, and they've approved it.
Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not suggesting that we get into that in this bill at all, Mr. Schaftel. Is there something, is it, if this is not a good activities, these Stoneleys or whatever they're called?
Stoley.
Is that something that the legislature should look at doing in another piece of legislation or something? Is this a loophole that we need to close or something? Not in this bill.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think our insurable interest statute prohibits that right now. I don't think we have that problem here. Some states do, though.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions at this time. Dave, if you would stick around. Doug Blockmacher, did you have something you wanted to add from Alaska Trust Company?
Yes. My name is Douglas Blockmacher, and I'm president and CEO of Alaska Trust Company. And we'd just like to say that we support this bill. We think it's good for Alaska, good for Alaskans. It brings jobs and revenue to the state. And we just, hope that you will support the legislation.
Thank you, Doug. Beth Chapman is also online, and I know you've got a lot of work in this bill also over several years, and feel free to add something.
Thank you, Chairman. This is Beth Chapman, and I'm an attorney in Juneau. And I support this bill, and I'm really online just to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thank you.
Any questions from the committee? I don't want to force anything back past this committee quickly. However, this bill's been heard last year by most of us, many of us, and so I would entertain a motion unless somebody specifically requests me to keep it another cycle. So, Representative Grunberg.
Just one question. I'm not familiar with everything that was in the bill last time. The bill went to Labor and Commerce this time. I have a bunch of things in my file. I want to be sure that we're not missing anything. I have the bill was originally the A version, then became the U version, and is now the N version. I'm kind of looking at Ernest on this. Through the chair, may I?
Yes.
Ernest, am I right? That's how it went from A to U to N?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for the record, Ernest Prox, staff to Rep. Keller. Representative Grunberg, yeah, the initial version was A. We put in a draft CS in Labor and Commerce that was version U. That was amended Monday, and that and is now reflects the N version.
Okay, if I may, please. I have a couple of stray amendments here. I don't know anything about. There was U3, U2, and U3. Have those been adopted, or are they before us?
Yeah, through the chair, Rep. Grunberg, yes, U3 and U2 were adopted by the Labor and Commerce Committee. I just included them at the time I sent out the packet. It hadn't been read across into our committee. So that's just to show you guys what they are, what the amendments are.
I'll toss them. Is there anything that I'm sort of relying on you folks? We can minutely examine a one-sentence bill, but these are a little too long to read. I'm wondering, is there anything that was done in Labor and Commerce that that we should be concerned about? I'm asking both of you because you're the sponsor here.
As I understand it, in Labor and Commerce, they put a sunset on the bill, and I'm racking my brain on the other one. But the point is the sponsors and those that have testified have told me they have no problem with us moving it as it is amended. Well, do you remember what the other amendment was? I'm drawing a blank here, Ernest.
Yeah.
Is it?
Through the tracking, just go over them real quick. The first amendment was U3, and that clarified that the tax imposed on life insurance policies under AS 2909210, letter M, I think that's in section 37, that it applies to trusts that are formed under or governed by Alaska law. And it also stated that the effective date for that particular statute or the stated that Section 37 applies to life insurance policy that is on or after the effective date of that particular statute. And then the amendment two was U2, and that that was, this is the sunset provision, and it inserted a new section. I think it's Section 38, and basically it states that after 5 years of using Section 37, you revert back to Section 38. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Grunberg.
So that's kind of, it's going to be kind of a trial period. Is that,
yeah, the reason for putting in is that the, it's my understanding there's some committee members were concerned that that the Section 37 could cause the state to lose revenue, and so they wanted to float it as a trial for 5 years and then see where you're at and then go from there.
The only thing I would say is this points up once again how important it is to look at the annual LAA book, which tells us if something's sunsetting. Yeah. Because if people don't look at it, and if Dave Shaftel and the crew aren't on the ball, and Paul Richards and Blockmacher Brothers aren't on the ball, we could find this thing sunsetted. So I trust and hope that the legal hawks that are listening to this will be vigilant to be sure that we continue that subject if there's no danger.
Thank you. And I'm really grateful for the work that's been done on this bill and for making, giving us the best trust laws in the United States, as I understand it. And I'm both impressed and grateful. Representative Grunberg, or Lynn. I'm sorry. It's just no a habit, comment. You know?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any amendments, but I do have a motion I'd like
to. Yeah, good to go.
I'd like to move CS for House Bill number 102, Labor and Commerce, 28-LS0335/N. I don't know if there are any amendments here. We'll press ahead before we get one, and any fiscal notes?
Attached fiscal notes.
Individual recommendations.
Okay, so the HB 102 passes from committee, and we'll take a little of these, and next we'll go up to HB 1. Back on the record, we're going to go to HB 1, State Affairs version, and we have version O in front of us. That's what we got. So, Representative Lynn, if you've got...
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. This is second time this bill has come before this committee. It's a very simple bill. It one page, one paragraph. It's co-sponsored by Representative Hawker, Chenault, and Johnson, Representative Olson, Millett, Peggy Wilson, Representative Keller, and Representative Isaacson. And it simply, a quick review, it simply enables the DMV to issue a driver's license for a period of less than 5 years for persons who have a legal presence in the United States for less than 5 years. Basically, that's it. Under current law, a foreign national visiting the United States with a visa that expires in 2 weeks can get a driver's license that doesn't expire for 5 years. This bill simply links the duration of the driver's license to the duration of the visa or any other legal presence document. And if the legal presence document is for an indefinite period or provisional period, the driver's license would be issued for only 1 year, but could be renewed each year up to a period of 5 years at no additional cost. And a similar legislation is passed in 36 other states, plus our District of Columbia. And that's it in a nutshell.
Okay.
And I do have my staffer here, and I have, it should be in your packet, FAQs for this bill here. If I can look at it if you'd like.
Okay. Thank just. You. For the committee's information, we have Dean Wasson online from the Department of Homeland Security that wants to testify in the bill, and we have Jeffrey Mittman from the ASLU that wants to testify in the bill, and then we also have DMV online and the AG's office for answering questions. So with that backup, is there, did you want to add anything? Okay, so that we're to the discussion. Let's stop. Let's take the testimony first, because we've got two waiting to testify. Is there questions? You got questions on the presentation?
I think for Forrest, possibly.
Okay, go for it.
The difference between the State Affairs CS and the original bill seems to me the elimination of the phrase by mail on line 11. And is that, Forrest, is that through the chair? Is that the only change?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. For the record, my name is Forrest Wolf. I'm staff to Representative Poplin. That's correct. That's the only change. DMV recommended we take out by mail because they wanted to open it up for in the future. They're hoping to be able to do driver's license renewals online, and they just didn't want to limit it to just by mail. So that's the only change.
I should ask, is there going to be somebody from DMV on the line?
Yes.
Okay, because my question to them will be, do they plan to allow renewal now by mail? Maybe I should ask them, or?
Well, when they get, we'll, they're online for questions, and we will call them up as soon as okay. The two that thank get done. That, yeah. Okay, any other questions, clarifications on the bill before we get testimony? Seeing none, Dean Wasson from Department of Homeland Security, if you would identify yourself and give us your testimony.
My name is Dean Wasson. I'm a supervisory special agent with Homeland Security Investigations. Thank you, Representative Lynn. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last time we were here and spoke on the bill, I believe that there was an email from Margaret Stock, an attorney who may or may not live in Alaska, but certainly practices law here. I wanted to answer specifically some of the questions that she brought up in her email that were not addressed during the last hearing, if I may.
Oh, thank you. Yes, Dean, go right in.
Okay. I'll go through point by point and summarize. I'm not sure if the representatives have the email there in front of them, but I'll just summarize some of the points and make a counter argument that I believe is applicable in some of these cases. First of all, I'd like to ask
Dean, if you could get real close to the phone and speak up just a little bit, and we'll turn up the volume here a little bit.
Okay.
And just a second, Representative Ledoux has a question for you.
I do too.
Yeah, I understand you work for Homeland Security. I just want to clarify. Are you testifying on behalf of Homeland Security, or is your testimony that for yourself exclusively?
My testimony is that of a private citizen and resident of the state of Alaska, and I am here at the request of Representative Lynn to possibly clarify any questions that the representatives may have about immigration law. I have been enforcing immigration law for over 15 years and am currently a resident living and working in the state of Alaska. I'm not testifying on behalf of, nor do my opinions have anything to do with the department itself.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I have a question for you, Dean. Have you talked to Margaret about the testimony at all, and does she know that I mean, not that you'd know what she knows, but I mean, is she aware that you're explaining her memo?
No, sir, not to my knowledge, and I'm not sure that I'm actually explaining her memo. I just recall that there were some questions that were brought up by her memo during the last hearing, and there seemed to be some misconceptions or some points that were raised in that memo that I would like to clarify. Last time I opened myself to questions and nobody had any questions. However, there are some inconsistencies in the statements that she has made in the memo that I would like to clarify. I'm not exactly explaining her memo, however.
Dean, don't misunderstand. I appreciate very much that you're doing that. I just wanted to put on the record where we're at with that. So go, yeah.
Yep.
Cool.
Chairman.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. Dean, just for information, this is Representative Millett. Margaret Stock lives in my district. She does actually live in Alaska, practice law, but she also practices law down in Washington, D.C., and is a immigration expert herself. So I just wanted to put that on the record because you said she may or may not live in the state of Alaska, but she does actually vote in my district and is a registered voter and does live there with her husband.
Okay, thank you for the clarification, ma'am. The last time I had any information, she was living in California, so thank you.
Okay, go ahead with your testimony then, Dean. I'm sorry.
Okay, the first thing that I would like to say is just bring up the question here, if any of the representatives have ever visited a foreign country, and have they ever applied for or obtained a driver's license in the foreign country where they're visiting. So if they could put themselves in the situation of somebody visiting the United States or visiting a foreign country, and they can put themselves in the shoes of somebody visiting the United States from a foreign country, I think that would put this issue into a much better perspective. Individuals visiting the United States, specifically Alaska, per the Alaska state laws, are not required to obtain a driver's license, and they can drive in Alaska for 90 days without obtaining a driver's license. So any instances where Ms. Stock brings up problems with visitors or temporary visitors to the United States not being able to easily obtain an Alaska driver's license, I would like to say that, first of all, that that's not necessary, and I'm not exactly sure that even though the law, the way it's going to be written, would allow that to happen for a period of stay, that that's, you know, necessarily an appropriate thing to do. So that brings us to the H-2B oil field and fishing industry workers that she mentioned that are given permission to be in Alaska seasonally. Again, they could obtain a driver's license with an expiration date that of their period of admission if, in fact, that were appropriate. However, more than likely, those individuals would fall into that 90-day category and not need to obtain a driver's license from the state of Alaska for any reason that I can possibly think of. She also mentions that there are students and people who are in the United States for indefinite periods of time that would make it difficult for DMV to determine what their duration of status is. I've talked to Ms. Erickson with the DMV, and I've provided her with access to a 24-hour telephone number to reach my office to verify status and the period of admission for foreign students or anybody who presents documents that are not on their face indicative of their period of admission. And so I've also checked with both Citizenship and Immigration Services and the other branch of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Detention and Removal Operations Branch, and just to double-check to make sure that everybody who is in the United States lawfully is eligible to obtain identification of their status from Citizenship and Immigration Services in various, to various degrees. She mentions an equal protection issue. I think that that's probably going to be covered by the Department of Law, so I'm not going to cover that. She says that the bill would change the way DMV conducts business, and that's simply not correct. They're already required to check the documents of any individuals who are in the country that are claiming that they're not citizens and that are applying for a driver's license. This would just be checking those documents and using the expiration date of those documents to determine the duration of the status of the license. She also makes an example of a law that's in another state that it's completely different from the proposed legislation, and it's not even fair to compare the two, so I won't be discussing that any further. She indicates that the DMV would be enforcing federal law, and that's simply not true. No enforcement would take place. DMV would simply rely on the documents that the person possesses. to determine their eligibility to obtain a driver's license, and they're not being asked by this law or by anything else to take any sort of enforcement action or to do anything affirmatively, you know, to individuals who don't present the proper documentation, just as it is today. It's exactly that. It's not asking them to do anything that they're not already doing today. The next point that she brings up here are that, you know, there are individuals in the United States for indefinite periods of time, and that it would be more accurate to say indeterminate periods of time, but each of those individuals are eligible, like refugees or asylees, to obtain employment authorization documents, and the employment authorization document is one document that is accepted by DMV for both legal status in the United States and for identification for an alien to be able to obtain a driver's license. The next point that she makes is about, you know, the cost of being given access to systems that would be able to tell what somebody's status is. And as I've already stated, I've provided with to DMV free of any charge the ability to check immigration status with my office, like I said, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. She talks about more costs and additional money for taxpayers, but in actuality, it will discourage individuals from coming to Alaska to exploit a vulnerability which allows people who are otherwise ineligible to either be in the United States or to remain in the United States to obtain legal identification. When status changes, new documents will be issued to those individuals by CIS. Of course, this is not instantaneous, but I don't believe that it would cause any more burden than somebody who comes into the state from another state, like myself, 5 years ago when I moved to Alaska, and I had to get a copy of my Social Security card, which I did not have with me, or an official copy of my birth certificate. And so they sent me away with no driver's license until I was able to get those things, and then I came back in, applied for, and received them. So those are the comments that I have based on Ms. Stock's email that she wrote in. And again, I would please encourage any representatives that have any questions about immigration law, the enforcement of immigration law, or how this bill would change how things are done as far as immigration law to go, to please ask me any questions that they might have.
Thank you, Dean. Any questions for Dean?
May I see the witness list, please?
Thank you so much. You're going to stick around in case there's more. We have some questions for you. It would be appreciated.
That would be appreciated.
Yes, sir. No problem.
Thank you. Jeffrey, are you online? Jeffrey Mitvin.
I am, Mr. Chair.
Identify yourself and give us your testimony. And I believe I believe we have a letter from you, all of us, in front of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Jeffrey Mittman. I represent the ACLU of Alaska. And as the Chair noted, we provided written testimony to the committee. I won't reiterate what's contained in there. I would make a few supplementary points.
Jeffrey, can you talk up just a little bit? Get close to the mic.
Certainly. Is that better, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, that's much better. Thank you.
Great. With respect to immigration issues, there is no contention by the ACLU, nor would I suppose by Attorney Stock, that this law will change how immigration is handled. That is one of the points, in that immigration is an issue that is reserved solely to the federal government, and there are significant preemption issues were the state of Alaska to pass this bill. Secondarily, it is not a contention that this bill would impose new immigration requirements, rather that the complexity of federal immigration requirements, the need that there are attorneys who specialize in this area, that there are federal departments who are trained and to deal this area, is exactly the point. The DMV doesn't have that training, does not have that expertise. To assert that the DMV might be able to rely on the expertise of a federal agency is really inaccurate. The DMV is there to issue driver's licenses, it has an area of expertise, which is, are individuals qualified to drive on the roads? Do they know the laws of our state? Are they able to safely operate a vehicle? That's what we ask the state DMV to do. There are a myriad of complicated immigration statuses, and I think Attorney Stock is the most qualified to discuss those. I am happy, I'm sure the committee could arrange to provide her testimony, rather a transcript of today's testimony, to address these issues. Finally, with respect to the constitutional issue, which is where the ACLU has expertise, currently under U.S. law, as noted in our testimony, immigrants are a suspect class. They have been subject to discrimination. There are laws protecting them.
If you would, you must be setting back a little bit, so if you would, speak up.
There is jurisprudence protecting immigrants. They are a suspect class under our federal equal protection jurisprudence. To assert that the state of Alaska will treat them differentially and burden them with different requirements for a driver's license when there's no need to do so would raise equal protection concerns and would needlessly entangle the state of Alaska in litigation. There is no assertion that this HB1 would impact in any way who can or cannot come into this country. It would not make the road safer, so it is not closely tailored to any legitimate state interest. It's simply unnecessary and does not do anything to further safety in the roads or to help protect our nation's borders. For those reasons, we would certainly urge the committee to simply not pass this bill out of committee. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Jeffrey. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mittman, I regularly review articles, news articles, and things from all across the country. And in the last two or three, 4 weeks, I have seen at least one article, maybe more than one article, listing some court decisions on what I believe are laws in other jurisdictions similar to House Bill 1. Could you comment whether are you aware of any court cases specifically that have dealt with equal protection issues on legislation in other states similar to House Bill 1?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we can pull some references for you. Clearly, there are a myriad of political and legal issues arising in the immigration context. We would note that the trend in states is actually towards allowing even greater leniency towards ensuring that anyone who is on a state's roads is a safe driver, is insured. It is the general course and better practice to allow any individual who will be driving to be safe. In that respect, I think it's instructive to note that state DMVs are recognizing that they do not have expertise and cannot control immigration issues. It is a better course to cover driving issues. With respect to specific cases, we will be happy to supplement our written testimony and provide that to the committee.
Mr. Chair, this bill's been around for a while. I don't want to burden the bill with additional time. I'm close to wearing out my welcome, and I'm close to the door here, so I don't want to exit. I think the reason this bill was referred here to this committee was to look at legal issues, and unfortunately, I don't see anything in, well, there are discussion of cases, but I know that I've just been given through my staff within the last few weeks some cases that have dealt with these kinds of laws, and I think maybe some of them have upheld them and some of them haven't, and
Grunberg, your question was appreciated about, you know, whether there are cases out there, but that's a comment. We're not quite into that stage of the debate yet. Erling Johansson, are you online from the Attorney General's office?
Yes, Chairman, I am.
Erling, you've been listening to the discussion here, and you've heard the threat of myriad complex lawsuits coming toward DMV, and DMV has told us that they can handle the requirements of the bill really well. Do you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, I have a letter in your file, should be in your file from some months back, where I see no problem with this bill. I stick with that opinion despite the written testimony from Ms. Stock and Mr. Mittman and the verbal testimony from Mr. Mittman. This is not a preemption of federal authority. This is a matter of people coming into the DMV with the federal documentation that they are to be here and have the driver license therefore issued for the time they're here. The concern that DMV does not have the expertise to handle documentation is questionable to me for certain, because DMV spends their whole day in and day out dealing with documentation that people bring in. And as far as constitutional issues, I don't see this as an equal protection or a due process matter. This is essentially neutral as far as treating people equally. The federal government decides who is in, who is not in. Those of us who are in, we get the license for 5 years. Those who are allowed in for a limited period get the license for the duration of their stay. I'm not familiar with the number of cases that were just referred to as having trouble with this type of bill, but I did check after reading Ms. Stock's letter, statutes in Tennessee, Colorado, and I believe the other one is New Hampshire, and they still seem to have similar statutes on their books. And there was no reported cases in Ms. Stock's letter, but there was one, Sanchez v. State, 692 Northwest 2nd 812, IO 2005. That was a class action by illegal aliens and licensed drivers against the state, alleging that the refusal of the state of Iowa, which is a little different, these licenses are not being refused, they're being granted for a limited term, but in that case, refusal of the state of Iowa to issue driver's licenses to illegal aliens violated the state and federal constitutions. Supreme Court of Iowa, affirming the district court's dismissal of the action, held that the state's driver's licensing scheme, which required production of a Social Security number or federal documentation authorizing foreign nationals' presence in the country, was rationally related to the legitimate state interest of not allowing its governmental machinery to be a facilitator for the concealment of illegal aliens, and it did not violate the state constitution or federal equal protection rights. So there's a police power involved in these cases, and I still don't see equal protection issues in this case, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for Early? Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Mr. Johansson, have you done any independent research on whether any courts have looked at similar statutes and issued reported decisions, say, within the last year or two?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, it was probably about a month ago that I did some searching for these types of cases, and I did not specifically come up with any.
May I inquire of Mr. Mittman the same question?
Thank you. Erling, if you would stick around, if there's further questions, I would appreciate it. Jeffrey Mittman, are you still there?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg?
To the chair, Representative Grunberg, the cases we cited have to do generally with federal consideration of state laws that impact on immigration areas. With respect to state laws that restrict driver's licenses to those who are legally present in the country, There are certainly a significant number of cases that find that that is permissible. What this HB1 does is significantly different, however. This does not impact the right of undocumented workers to receive license. This has to do with those who are legally present in a country, and the rights who are of those who are legally present are significantly different.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
Have you found any cases in your research that review the constitutionality of statutes like House Bill 1?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we have, for example, a case, and it is cited, Takahashi v. Fish and Game Commission was a U.S. Supreme Court case. It specifically states that a state cannot adopt a classification that prevents lawfully admitted aliens from earning a living in the same way that other state inhabitants earn their living. So the case law is very clear. When you are differentially burdening someone who is lawfully present in the country and setting up a different standard for them that imposes a special condition, the courts are clear that that is not permissible.
Representative Millett.
Jeffrey Mittman, good to hear from you again. Hey, I have a question. So you just cited a case that was Fish and Game versus, so we're talking about a fishing license, not a driver's license, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, that is correct. And again, what we have to do is look at jurisprudence that assesses the rights of those who are legally present in the country. For the suspect classification of legally present immigrants, because the courts are aware that there can be discriminatory laws passed against immigrants, there's a significant body of case law that looks at differential burdens on their rights. So we will continue to search for specific driver's license cases.
So can you cite a specific driver's license case, not a fishing license, not anything other than a driver's license issued by a state that has gone through the constitutional challenge?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, I would refer to another U.S. case, that's Hines v. Davidowitz, again, also in a written testimony. That had to do with a Pennsylvania ID card, and again, which is fairly similar to a general driver's license. And in that case, again, the identification requirement was invalidated. So I think that's probably the most closely analogous. I think often we think of a driver's license and a state-issued ID card as the most closely analogous. So I think that would be most instructive. Again, that's Hines v. Davidowitz, 312 U.S. 52.
Follow up, if you would.
So you absolutely have no constitutional challenges to a driver's license. A photo ID is not the same, does not give you the same rights as a driver's license, Mr. Mittman. With all due respect, you're talking about fishing licenses, state IDs, and the question was, do you have a specific case where the driver's license under a bill similar to this is challenged constitutionally? And you're just pulling out fishing game and IDs. I would like a driver. I would like you to testify if there is a driver's license case.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, what we are trying to provide the committee with is what is the constitutional analysis with regard to state laws that impact on immigrants. So, for example, as we have testified, where states have said that they will not issue a driver's license to undocumented workers, to those who are not present in the country. It is clear that those have been permitted. We are not familiar with another state that has said, we are allowing you to issue a driver's license to a legally present individual, which of course is permissible, but we are going to treat them differently. What we can do, what we must do in the law, is look for similar analyses, and so that is the best at this moment we can provide you. If the committee is aware or if the sponsor is aware of an exactly similar law in another state, we would certainly be happy to review that.
Oh, did you have a follow-up?
I do have a follow-up. And with all due respect, Jeffrey Mittman, I appreciate, you know, what you do, but coming to us with cases, citing cases that don't directly impact the bill that we're looking at, and then, I mean, are you planning, if this bill passes, are you planning on suing over this driver's license bill? we threatened to sue over the ordinance that just passed municipality, but you just quoted in the paper you're not going to pursue a lawsuit at this time. So I feel like sometimes we're being threatened by the ACLU on actions that we're taking, and then your testimony isn't true and accurate, which is uncomfortable for me because I want to deal in facts, not on a fishing license case or a state ID case. I want a specific driver's license case, and you dance around the subject, but the truth is you don't have a driver's license case that's been constitutionally challenged under a bill like this.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, the ACLU is always absolutely careful in all of our testimony to not misrepresent and not make threats. It is important that we know that the legislators trust us, that we are providing the best available information. So, for example, with respect to the recent assembly issue, we advised the assembly that there was a free speech implication, and we've been assured that that would be fixed. We don't want to sue. We never want to sue. We want to work cooperatively with either a state or local body, and we are always happy to ensure that rights are protected. With respect to this specific issue, we have expertise in constitutional areas and in legal analysis. As any lawyer who practices knows, there will often be a situation where you will not have a case on all fours. If there is a case on all fours, we will cite that, whether that is in for or against our position. However, when there is not a case on our fours, it is our duty to accurately and professionally and ethically advise the legislature of our best analysis of what the legal situation is, which is what we have done here. If there were a case on all fours that said, here's what a state did who restricted the right of a legal immigrant to obtain a license, we would advise the legislature of whether that was approved or disproved. Failing that, what we must do, what all lawyers do, is look to similar cases to the jurisprudence in that area and so advise the court. We would never threaten any legislative body. That is not appropriate. It would not be ethical. What we do is provide careful and accurate testimony.
Can I have one follow-up? Mr. Mittman, when was the Hines case decided? What year was that?
The Hines case is a case from 1941, through the chair.
Okay, we'll stop there. Now, Representative Ledoux has a question, but I want to give opportunity to the committee to bring a motion forward on the bill today, if it's there, and because I don't think there's any questions so far that have been put on the table that are unanswered. I think that it's a matter of decision where we're going. But
I just wanted to clarify. There's absolutely no statute like this. We've got 49 other states. 49 other states, and I mean, I'm not in love with this bill, but it would seem like there would have been someplace else that would have enacted something at least similar to that.
We'll go back to the sponsor on that response.
There is. We have 36 other states plus D.C.
have bills or through very, the chair.
Very similar to this.
And I want to ask somebody, either the sponsor or Mr. Mittman or anybody else who wants to put their two cents in, has anybody challenged any of these statutes in any of the other states?
That's my question.
My staffer is saying no.
Well, I think we've gotten the answer twice. The Department of Law told us no. And now Jeffrey has been demonstrated no. You know, I mean, I don't know who else we want to ask. Representative Grunberg.
I'd like to associate myself with the last two representatives. I don't know. I was one of the no votes last time. Representative Peterson and I were the two no votes, as I recall. Unless Representative Cisna was at some point, but so I can't say I have had overwhelming support for my concern. But here in this committee, what we're tasked with doing is looking into in this case, the constitutionality of this bill, and you know, I don't want to stand in the way of something that the chair wants to do here. And or that the majority of the committee wants to do, but I've got to say, I am not satisfied on either side that there's been really enough research to see whether any of the 36 statutes are exactly like this, and if so, whether courts have looked at them, and if so, how they've come out.
particularly on federal constitutional issues. I seem to recall some decisions fairly recently from federal district courts, but I don't know the underlying text of the laws they looked at. And frankly, when I get these, I just tell my staff to put them in, because I know this bill's coming up, but it didn't find its way into the file. And maybe if you want to move the bill, I can look at it after the bill moves or something. The bill goes to the floor, and then it goes over to the Senate. But I got to say, before it goes to the governor, I certainly hope, and I will see what we can do to try to find out the answer to these questions. And we've got Margaret Stocks, an A-rated immigration lawyer. She and Keith Bell are the only two A-rated immigration lawyers in Alaska, and I'm not sure Pete's still practicing. But she was a professor at West Point, as Representative Lynn will remember. She's testified in state affairs. I think you know that, too. And I don't know why she's not here. We tried to reach her, and Ted wasn't able to reach her. And we've got Mr. Johansson and Mr. Mittman, and I just will be not a happy camper if we do some research and find out there are 10 cases out there on identical bills, and they've all upheld this or struck it down. But I think this needs more research somewhere before the governor gets it.
Respectfully, I really take it very serious, the question of constitutionality and whether or not there are other cases. And I would say that if you find 10 other cases where there has been action on this, I would think you would have a very good floor debate, and I'm very comfortable if the committee wants to move the bill, to move it. I just don't see much future in holding it in, for more questions. But Representative Millett.
You're doing your research, Representative Groenberg. Will you make sure we're not talking about fishing licenses?
Okay. This Takahashi case was an issue in my constitutional law textbook in 1968. And I know that the Hines versus Davinovich was in there, too. So these ain't new cases around. You probably had it in your casebook, too.
Probably.
Yeah, I remember the case.
Well, we're over time, and I really appreciate the committee for doing that.
I will not oppose the bill.
Okay, is there a motion? I don't think you ought to make it.
No, I think somebody else.
Okay. We'll spare the sponsor from moving his own bill.
Mr. Chair, I move HB 1 State Affairs Version O out of committee with the accompanying fiscal notes and recommendations.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank the committee.
No objection. Thank you. And I thank the committee, too, for the work on the series.
Just for the record, I'm going to be a no rec because I don't have enough.
Okay. Okay, we're adjourned at 3:07, and again, thank you for your involvement.